right. So, Ron, let's start by having you tell us about Signal Peak Ventures.
Sure. Well, again, pleasure to be here with you, Shimano. So, Signal Peak Ventures is a early stage venture fund out of Salt Lake City. We also have a growth group within our organization, but we have about $500 million under management in the firm. We invest in software companies, mostly Series A and Series D rounds, and our focus is typically in the Mountain West region of the United States. We define that as Utah, Colorado, Arizona, and New Mexico. We do some investing outside of the region, but that is typically more on an opportunistic basis. Maybe we have touch points with entrepreneurs that came in and out of Utah or Colorado. We have worked with them in the past. But for the most part, focus on the software market, software as a service in particular, and we have a couple different sectors. We have enterprise software, we have a consumer group, and then we have what we call small business and very small business group that looks at various opportunities as well.
So let's focus the discussion on your early stage software SaaS investment activities. And can you double click down and tell us a bit more about what is the investment thesis? What are you thinking? How are you looking at the software industry, its evolution, its current trends, its future, and where are you placing your bets? What is the logic behind what you're doing?
Yep, sure. Great question. So first and foremost, you know, we love the software business. It has great fundamental underpinnings. You know, you can see a business that typically has a gross margin anywhere between 70 and 90%. Obviously, recurring revenue themes are very, very attractive for us and any other investor where you have, you know, a stream of revenue that you can create over time as the business grows that you can really bank on and count on and to really build the business in a pretty significant manner. And, of course, as you get more growth over several years, then that is really akin to a snowball rolling down the hill where you have revenue that just, you know, grows nicely for the firm. So the fundamentals of the software business are very, very attractive to us just based on that as a drop back. The second thing that we really like is there are many metrics that you can use across the software market that allow you to measure and manage you know, the company's success. So customer acquisition costs, lifetime value you know, of a customer, a number of different key metrics that you can use and apply across multiple software scenarios, whether those are enterprise software, small business, or consumer-based software. So the drop back in particular for the software market is compelling. You know, we do see businesses that have both an on-premise offering typically as well as a cloud offering, and sometimes that migration isn't as fast as you would think. Many customers still like a premise-based system depending on their background and infrastructure, where they may be a government entity or a entity in the intelligence community or military that can't go to the cloud, or if they do have to go to the cloud, they go to a secure. But most of our businesses start to migrate towards you know, a cloud offering and then have the greater percentage of their business in the cloud, and I think that trend will continue. You know, as mentioned, we like three different sectors in the space. There's three partners at our firm. My specialty is probably more on the enterprise software side. Two other partners have a lot of depth in both the consumer software side as well as small business and what we call very small business. So initiatives and tools that are designed to support, you know, businesses that maybe have 1 to 10 employees or from 10 to maybe a couple hundred. Our consumer offerings are really interesting. We have platforms that scale into the tens of millions of users with a couple of our companies. And then, of course, the enterprise software is tends to be, you know, cybersecurity, infrastructure software, data disaster recovery, backup. So we do see a broad array of different sectors in the market and like all three of those sectors.
So one thing that I find very intriguing is what is happening in Utah. We've covered a number of great companies in Utah. That includes Pluralsight, that includes Inside Sales. And you know, we've also covered a lot of smaller companies. And many of them have been here at these roundtables also. So it seems as though there's a bit of a technology startup hub developing in Utah. Could you talk about what you're seeing and what is the history and how, why is this happening?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, Shramana. So, you know, I moved to Utah in 1988, so it's been a while now. But if you think about the roots of the state, if you go back to that time frame, companies such as Novell and WordPerfect and iOmega, mm-hmm. those are names that are really no longer around, but created the fundamentals, if you will, of a technology ecosystem here in Utah yeah. from the days that have kind of continued to throughout today. You know, you fast forward over a couple of decades and look at the development in the state, you've got some great fundamentals that are here that are really attractive to people that would like to be involved in these ecosystems. Number one, you've got a great quality of life. We've got beautiful mountains in our background. We only have 3 million people in the state. We don't have 40. So, you know, there's less stress on the infrastructure as far as quality of life. We've got great schools here in University of Utah, Brigham Young University, a couple of other the community colleges that really spawn great development, great science and engineering, and just a growing ecosystem of technologists who want to live here. So the roots of the state in and of itself sort of bring us forward to a scenario where you have now thousands of companies that are now here and growing, and you know, a fair amount of capital that's here to support those companies. So you have ourselves and two or three other firms here in the state that invest locally. We've got some really nice emerging seed funds that are allowing, you know, early stage efforts to get launched. And then, you know, we all oftentimes attract, you know, capital from the Bay Area or from the East Coast.
Yeah.
Once companies hit a certain critical mass and size, and you referenced a couple of them, whether those are Pluralsight or inside sales, you know, once a company hits a certain growth stage, oftentimes that attracts capital that comes from out of state that, you know, is able to write much larger checks to facilitate some of the growth that the seed funds, folks like ourselves and others, have facilitated and helped drive the businesses to that stage. So, you know, long story short, Shramana, we've got a great ecosystem here that's developing based on the universities, the history of the state, the entrepreneurial culture. So, you know, there's a lot happening in Utah right now. It's an exciting place to be. I think anybody who's here is seeing it, sensing it, feeling it, and it's just a lot of fun. So we're pleased to be here. Yeah, as mentioned, we don't, you know, exclusively invest in Utah. The thesis is Rocky Mountain region, so we do invest in the yeah. other states, as I mentioned, opportunistically outside of the state. But a good majority of our deal flow, I'd say 60 to 70% of the deals that we do and are in our current portfolio are going to be right here in the backyard.
You know, a couple of points to add to what you said is I started seeing a bit of an inflection point in Utah after Omniture. You know, Omniture was a very visible success out of Utah, and Adobe acquired, Omniture went public, then Adobe acquired Omniture, and that has been kind of one of the milestone and highly visible success stories. That's one, you know, inflection point to note. And the other thing from a trend point of view that I have observed is that companies from Utah have done great bootstrapping. Both the companies, Pluralsight and Inside Sales, were bootstrapped to a very large degree. They actually did not take much early stage capital at all. And when, by the time they took capital, that capital was, you know, a lot of capital, and it's not a traditional Series A by any stretch of imagination. These were very large amounts of capital from Silicon Valley, actually. And they've, you know, I think that that kind of underscores the culture of your ecosystem, which is not at all the ecosystem culture in Silicon Valley. In Silicon Valley, people are obsessed with venture capital as early as possible, whereas I think, and this is, by the way, very much the philosophy of 1 million by 1 million, I think you have a more sustainable basic cultural framework in Utah, which has its underpinning in bootstrapping as opposed to this, you know, mad rush for capital as early as possible.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think those are great points, and maybe just to kind of respond to that a bit. So, yeah, there's been a couple different waves here in the state. I mentioned the early days of Novell, WordPerfect, iOmega. You know, those businesses thrived deep into the 90s, maybe change. And then along came Omniture, and I was CEO of a company called Phobos, which was acquired by a Bay Area company. So you had two or three or four other companies that sort of thrived in those early 2000 years. And then you had, of course, the Great Recession that slowed things down and caused a dearth of capital and some changes in the ecosystem. And then the last 3 or 4 years, I think, coming out of the recession, there's been a lot of capital, there's been a lot of growth, and there's been a lot of enthusiasm for investing, you know, back into the state. To your comment on early stage investing versus, you know, patient capital versus perhaps bringing in capital later on for growth, I do think the state in particular is known for probably more bootstrapping. Valuations tend to be much more reasonable here at the entry points than perhaps other areas in the country, notably Silicon Valley, of course. So you do oftentimes see more attractive investments at least entering, you know, at the entry point. To your last point, if you look at Pluralsight in particular, I think they were probably 10 or 12 years old before they even brought in capital. So that's kind of an amazing itself as far as bootstrapping the business, having a different mindset, and then, you know, many of the dollars that have come into those businesses, both Pluralsight and I think Inside Sales in particular, have been secondary transactions where the founders and maybe early employees took some capital off the table, and then there was a fair amount of money available to continue to reinvest into the growth of the company. Yeah. So there has been some of that. I think in the last couple of years, we're seeing a little bit more of a traditional bent towards seed. The seed market here really growing. Series A investments becoming a little bit broader, a little bit more traditional. Valuations still being relatively reasonable in our opinion, which makes it a great place to continue to work and invest. But sometimes those change. Sometimes valuations can pop up and get a little bit more frothy, and we and others have to be, you know, careful and balanced with the entrepreneurs as we look at the type of capital and what type of valuations that we're investing in.
What is your definition of an attractive Series A investment? And I'll let me give you some color on what exactly I'm looking for here. So in Silicon Valley, a lot of Series A investors today in SaaS are looking for $1 million ARR already in place before people are willing to make Series A investments. And their expectation is the entrepreneurs have gotten to that point either through bootstrapping or through other kinds of seed investments, friends and family investment, whatever way, but they want to come in after the 1 million ARR mark is hit. And there are two kinds of funds we see. We see there are actually small funds that are willing to do $1 to $3 million investments and keep this in kind of like a capital efficient mode. And then there are these big funds who don't do $1 to $3 million investments. They need to invest in large chunks because they're larger funds and they can only manage so many companies based on how many partners they have. And they can't do these smaller deals. So they immediately want to put in lots of money and then the whole game changes because you have to, you know, you're basically the bar is much higher. So how do you define for me, what is your definition of Series A? Is it small chunks of investment in at mid, you know, what is the threshold at which you would like to come in?
Yeah, no, great question. That $1 million in annual recurring revenue is a great benchmark. Do we always achieve that when we see something that looks compelling? No, but we want to see at least a path to that and then, you know, potential, you know, hyper growth following those early stage years in the company's cycle. So I think we're looking for just as much promise of accelerated growth, and $1 million is certainly a nice benchmark that I think is fairly common throughout the U.S. But we tend to underwrite to, we always look at three key things. We look at the management team, we look at the technology, and we look at how big do we believe the addressable market is. And you know, sometimes on that last piece, you don't know for sure. But you are taking a pretty, you know, good estimate of how large you think, you know, the company's customer base could be. We take a lot of our cues from the management team. How strong is this team? Whether they have had prior successes in startups or they are people that are coming out of larger corporations with just great reputations and great management skills. And of course, the technology is very, very important. If you're going to be a smaller entity here in Salt Lake or Denver or Phoenix, and you're going to try to change the world with your product offering, it's got to be excellent. It's got to be best of breed technology. And so those are the three things that we're typically looking for as we underwrite to an investment. And then we're looking for that, you know, that growth potential to be there. So, you know, in summary, we'd love to see $1 million run rate. Sometimes we invest later. Sometimes we see a business that's doing $500,000, $600,000, $700,000, but looks like they have the promise to grow pretty significantly based on those three, you know, that three-legged stool I just described as far as the underpinnings of our investment.
And what is a typical round size for you? How much do you like to put in?
No, we typically put anywhere in between $3 and maybe $5, $6, $7 million, and then reserve, you know, about the same amount for the investment over time. Our ownership structures tend to be between 15% and 25%. Mm-hmm. With that type of investment, our average check size up front is probably $5-6 million, and then again the reserve would be a double on that. So we're looking to invest.
And so when you do a Series A in that order, are you the only funds typically? Because these days people don't need as much money, even though there has been a, you know, frenzy of raising too much capital. You actually do not need as much money. So are you, when we're talking about a 5 million Series A, are we talking about a 10 million Series A because there's another investor involved, or are you the only money and you're willing to go at it alone?
Good question. We've done it either way, Sramana. So we've gone alone, and then we've gone mm-hmm. with the syndicate. And, you know, typically we like to syndicate our deals just because it brings more capital. It brings hopefully some broad-based thinking at the board level and some more expertise and depth in the area. When you're a Series A investor, occasionally you are just following a seed round by yourself and then looking to make, further syndicate expansion at the B level or maybe the
yeah.
C level, do A and B. But I'd say it's probably a mix. I'd say it's 50-50 at the A level. We have, you know, another firm at the table with us. The other half of that is we'll start the Series A ourselves and then look to grow the syndicate based on success of the business into the B rounds.
Let's talk a bit about what you're seeing in the Rocky Mountain area startups, especially in the early stages. So Utah, Colorado, Phoenix, in that general area, and you mentioned that you have three different practices, the enterprise practice, the small business focused practice, as well as consumer software practice. Can you give us some examples of interesting businesses that you have, you know, seen, invested in, that are representative of trends?
You bet. So let's start on the enterprise. We recently invested last year in a company called Rackware that has a very large presence here and also in the Bay Area. And that's a company that does disaster recovery, migration services, and public private cloud offerings. So that's just a really interesting piece of technology. We've partnered with IBM with that company and are selling mostly into the enterprise for migration services and disaster recovery, cloud-based infrastructure technology. That's a really mm-hmm. exciting company. They led that deal for us this past year, and that's an example, I think, on the enterprise side. On the consumer side, you know, we've been in a company called WildWorks, which is based here in Salt Lake for a while. This is a kids game that is a virtual world between mm-hmm. Joint venture between ourselves and National Geographic. We've created a virtual world called Animal Jam, and yeah, we have about 40 or 50 million kids around the world that are participants in this platform. There's a mobile offering on tablets and phones, of course, and then you have a web-based presence. That's a lot of fun. That's an example of our consumer strategy where we have a focus.
And that's a subscription model?
That's a subscription model on the web, and it's also an in-app purchase model on the mobile devices. So it's a bit of a hybrid
okay.
model. And so
yeah.
obviously you're seeing a lot of you know, gaming and infrastructure technology in that world move towards either subscription yeah. or in-app purchase, and then there's obviously
free-to-play.
Right, when you're free-to-play, and then you want to get into enhanced services and offerings, that's when the subscription kicks in. So So that's an example on the consumer side. Another consumer product offering we just invested in this last year is a company called Chatbooks. This is a really fun company that allows you to, every 60 photos you take, either on your phone or with Instagram or Facebook, you get automatically uploaded to a service that ships you a small scrapbook, if you will, that captures all of your memories. So instead of having all of your photos tied up on your phone and you're deleting or maybe you don't get back to those, this service allows you to, in effect, receive a small little photo book each month just based on the photos that you take. And that business is in hyper growth and has been a lot of fun for us. So there's some examples, I think, on the consumer side and then on the enterprise side. On very small business, we've got a really large company in Arizona called Infusionsoft that we've been with for a while now. That's a business
we've covered Infusionsoft extensively.
Okay. All right. So you know the business.
They have been around.
Small businesses for marketing initiatives and CRM.
The CRM. Can you adjust your phone so that the audio comes through? Sometimes you're just cutting out.
It's
going very low audio-wise.
Okay.
Infusionsoft is actually also same model as what we discussed earlier. It's a bootstrap first, raise money later model out of Arizona, and they bootstrap quite a ways before they raise money from the Bay Area, also from you guys, and also more. David O, I think, is in that company.
That's very good. That's exactly right. So I think those are some examples of investments that we've made in the past and some recent investments. I think we continue to see really nice trends across enterprise, the enterprise sector, the consumer sector, as well as very small business. 2 years ago, we invested in a company called Eastman Networks, which is a cybersecurity company here in Salt Lake.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a fair amount of depth in the cybersecurity market. We like it a lot. We've had a couple successful exits in the past out of the fund. So that's another example of, I think, the continuing trend in the cyber world. Albeit that world has become much more crowded, as you're well aware. There's a lot more attention and capital.
Very crowded. Very, very crowded. Talk to us about exits. What are some of the prominent exits from the Rocky Mountain ecosystem that you have seen, and what has that done to the ecosystem? Have these people stayed around and continue to work in that ecosystem as angels or repeat founders? What are the dynamics?
Yeah, we try to induce people to be repeat founders and like to see them stick around and maybe do one more with us after they've had a nice exit. It's been a pretty good couple of years for us on the exit standpoint. We just sold a company called C7 Data Centers just right here in Bluffdale, just south of Salt Lake City. While we didn't disclose that price, it was in a very attractive exit for the entrepreneurs and ourselves, and a business that had grown dramatically. We sold another company called Luxel Wireless last year to LeGrand, and LeGrand paid a little bit over $50 million for that business. Again, a smaller exit, but an exit that we had done very, very well. That was a business that sold, Wi-Fi technology, access points for the home automation market. So those are a couple of examples of recent exits that have been attractive to us. A couple of years ago, we sold a company called Solera Networks, which was in the cybersecurity sector. We sold that to Blue Coat Systems, who was ultimately acquired by Symantec. So there's been a fair amount of energy in our platform on the exit side, and all of those entrepreneurs have recycled back into the community, whether with us or with another firm. And are looking to do it again. It's pretty rare that you see an entrepreneur here, maybe in Salt Lake, go become just exclusively an angel investor. Sometimes our exits, while they're compelling, they may not be billion-dollar exits that you see in the Bay from time to time. So our model tends to be a little bit different in investing in the region. We can invest at a lower entry point and sell a business for a couple $100 million, and everybody does very, very well. It's somewhat germane to investing in these four or five states versus perhaps Bay Area investing that makes us a little bit different.
And do you have an estimate of how many technology startups are operating in this corridor, in the Rocky Mountain corridor?
Oh, gosh. I would say thousands, right? Literally.
Thousands?
think you would see between seed capital, Series A, across the region, literally, you know, thousands of companies here that maybe they're a little bit more established or are, you know, getting started or are on a 2, 3, 4, or 5 years into their journey. But I would put the estimate in those four states well into the thousands.
Great. Awesome. Well, thank you for enlightening us on your geography as well as what your activities have been. As I said, it's a trend that we have picked up, which is why we invited you to come and talk to our audience here, and we'll continue to cover them. So send us companies that are, you know, we cover $5 million plus revenue companies in the Entrepreneur Journey series, and we'll be happy to feature more of companies from the region. Thank you, Ron, for being here.
Anna, thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure to speak with you and talk a little bit more about our exciting region, and I very much appreciate the opportunity to spend the time.
Bye-bye. Take care.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.